I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
All right, we're back for episode 119 of Digital Divination. Ooh. Pause. Ron, pause.
Wait. Oh, that's me. Yes, I, Ron Lundeen, am an employee of Wizards of the Coast, and the opinions I express here are mine and not theirs.
Oh, wow. You know, I guess it's just been so long since we've done that, and it's just not automatic.
I know. But I'm no less an employee of theirs, and my opinions are no less theirs, or no more theirs. They're not theirs.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Anytime you take a pause that long, I get a little worried we're going to hear some bad news.
Oh, I know. It could have been a change, yeah. Maybe we didn't need to make the disclaimer.
we do have a little bit of bad news to impart, and that is to say we should talk a little bit about this old game and where it's going.
Starfinder First Edition,
right?
Yeah.
Because we're gonna be comparing and contrasting it with its younger edition, Starfinder Second Edition playtest.
Yes,
both editions are still valid.
But the new sexy one is just like catching everybody's eye.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, the old gal is, you know, not feeling it as well, I guess. I don't know.
Well, but you're right. There's still a lot of validity there. There are a lot of people that play all kinds of older editions of earlier games. I'm still playing a Pathfinder First Edition campaign.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, great.
Well, as Ron alluded to there, we're going to talk about some of the differences. We're not going to really qualify good or bad, just some of the differences between Starfinder First Edition and the Second Edition playtest as we see it now, knowing that that will change some between now and the release at Gen Con. In fact, there's already been some changes, some errata, based on some of the playtest feedback that's been given to the team so far.
Indeed. And we've all had a couple hours of play now, so we can talk a little more knowledgeably about how things are different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Although not publicly yet, right?
No.
No, we can talk about it publicly.
We can talk about it. Okay. Yes.
Yes.
We haven't had a couple of hours.
It's not a secret that we're playing. What I'm asking is at the for people who are listening to this, you know, the very day it comes out, as I'm sure most people are eagerly awaiting the next Digital Divination. But the only intrepid heroes they're hearing is still Intrepid Scoundrels. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, 3 days ago, because it's as of tomorrow,
right.
3 days ago, episode 14 of 16 will be published. And that one alludes to kind of the climactic event of that arc. So
there you go. Rapidly light speed heading towards the finale of Intrepid Scoundrels.
Yes. Like through hyperspace.
Yes.
Yeah.
But since
I couldn't
then,
remember what it was called. Sorry.
Yes.
You know, we could just call it The Drift based on the subject of today's conversation.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, so it's kind of, Ron has alluded to, we've played through, I think, 6 or 7 hours of the Cosmic Birthday playtest. And even before that, I had a session zero and did some work creating characters and things. So I do think we have some experience with that. Now, there's some obvious differences between the two. And then I think we'll drill a little bit more deeper than that in areas that we've experienced it some.
Right. You've got this, you know, the standard second edition Pathfinder sort of chassis of the three actions and the kind of the math of the of characters and proficiency ranks and you know plus 10 is equal to a critical hit. All that stuff is known. We all know that. The playtest has been out for a couple months. Has it been a couple months or just two? Yeah, 2 months. We'll say 2 months. All of that was known that that's the way the second edition Starfinder playtest was going. So, but let's talk a little bit about some specifics. I think maybe we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of character classes that we've seen on mm-hmm. the field of play. And then I guess anything else that just sort of pops into our minds.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Ron earlier, maybe a little bit about how the stories might differ from first edition to second edition. I thought maybe we could talk about how GMing it is a little bit different if you like as well.
Go ahead, Ron.
Oh, please. Oh, no, please.
No, I was just going to say one of the sort of the big things that I was sort of thinking about that it is kind of a big change that isn't maybe not as obvious, but it's been something that the team has talked about a lot is that the idea that Starfinder is, whether or not this is a change from first edition, but it's definitely a focus that Starfinder second edition stuff is going to be more focused on ranged, right? Ranged combat is kind of meant to be a bigger thing than it is in Pathfinder, and that it sometimes was ended up being in some cases on Starfinder first edition. So that is something that I'm trying to, as GM, trying to see if that is, how to apply that in the game. Now I'm sort of running a pre-written adventure, which comes with, maps of a certain size and all that. But, I'm finding it interesting that there's, talk about everyone should be using, for the most part, ranged attacks, which I think we've actually been seeing, four out of six, essentially, which is more than it would be in a normal sort of, I think, campaign.
Yeah, no, for sure. Ron, you were saying.
Yeah, the thing I wanted to talk about is a little more fundamental than that. One of the biggest differences between the types of heroes that you are in Starfinder First Edition versus the Starfinder Second Edition playtest is that because it's built on the Pathfinder Second Edition chassis, all the numbers go up all the time kind of fast, right, as you level, right? The way that you would get better, as an example, in Starfinder First Edition, the only way your armor class gets better is if you buy better armor. And so high level armors tend to have like ridiculous amounts of armor bonus onto them, such that you kind of have to have these guardrails about, well, who's going to get this armor? You can't give a character that's too low a level this armor, or their armor class, KACEIC are going to be just much too high. And you don't want to keep your armor for very long. You're sort of forced to work hard to upgrade your armor as well as your weapons in order to kind of keep a balance, keep the number balanced. But because everything's built into Pathfinder Second Edition, pulled in from Pathfinder Second Edition to Starfinder Second Edition playtest, those numbers go up with your levels and they kind of go up automatically. So if you've got kind of, let's throw on whatever station wear we've got because we're in the middle of a fight where we were all in our jammies when the aliens invaded or something like that, you're going to be a lot more competent in Starfinder Second Edition because in Pathfinder Second Edition, a lot of those bonuses are built into the characters. You don't have to go hunt for them in the gear, and all your numbers are going up at a more consistent, predictable way that makes sort of the heroes feel a lot bigger. You feel like you outgrow your lower levels, I think, a lot faster between Starfinder Second Edition and Starfinder First Edition. So it's a little harder to make villains that you face a little more memorable. If you happen to be 3-4 levels higher, they're just not, right? Their statistics have to grow as well because the hero's statistics are growing so fast. You're just kind of better, bigger, faster the higher level you get across the board. And that feels very different when telling stories in Starfinder First Edition as opposed to Starfinder Second Edition.
I like the fact that it's not so heavily gear dependent, Starfinder Second Edition, where so much of it is baked in. Now that said, when you get gear, it doesn't necessarily seem as cool, right? Because it's not loaded up with extra bonuses and stuff like that. There will be other things, I imagine, similar to in Pathfinder Second Edition that make it cool besides just the statistical amount that it bumps up your armor class.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the thing which hopefully will be the case when we see some of the higher level gear, which not many of us have seen, whether or not you've read the book or not. But like, you've got the sort of the normal sort of inflection points where you get the plus one armor, the plus one weapon, the plus, you know, the extra weapon die damage, et cetera, et cetera. But it gives you a chance to do the things. So you don't have to worry about that as much when you get the chance for when you're maybe making stuff for homebrew or whatever to make this thing that are cool. Like, oh, this is a regular gun, but what if I do this and add this sort of special once a day activation? I get to do a thing where I just shoot lasers out everywhere. I do a death blossom, right? And that'll be the thing that makes the thing cool rather than just be like, hey, yeah, this is just numerically better, slightly numerically better.
Right.
One of the ways I've leaned into that in Pathfinder Second Edition, the Strength of Thousands game that I play, I use automatic bonus progression. Now, a lot of people say that the default rule of free archetype, or the optional rule of free archetype, is so popular and so beloved, it really ought to just be a part of the game. I disagree. My opinion is automatic bonus progression ought to be a basic part of the game. That's where I would put my chips rather than free archetype, because then you're not worrying about the pluses at all. My group gets really excited when they find a Grievous rune, for example. That's a cool thing that we can put on a weapon to make somebody's critical specialization better. The items that they got, it's not, oh, I want a demon mask because it gives me plus one to my intimidation. That's already worked in an automatic bonus progression. They want a demon mask because you can literally scare people with it, with the fear spell. So I think leaning into that is a thing that's pretty exciting. I suspect to the extent I do run any of the Starfinder Second Edition, I may just fold in that automatic bonus progression, John, to have the things that you find feel non-rulesy, if that makes sense. I mean, obviously there's rules for all of them, but it makes you feel kind of special or as Jason would say, death blossomy.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, if I recall correctly, there was some talk a little bit about not about that sort of being the basic the thing that existed in the maybe like the Pathfinder Second Edition playtest, but there's a certain amount of psychological attachment in a lot of players to finding a simple plus one sword that gives you plus one to hit. And that's the thing that people want to find. Like, you know, they're still there. So it's way, way scaled back, right? That it's just the plus, you know, just those simple runes that, you know, makes it so that it had to be in the game in a way. Otherwise people would not feel the same way about finding treasure. It's partially sort of like a habit, tradition more than anything, that people want that stuff. And if they think, you know, I'm not saying, you know, players need to play differently or whatever, but like, you know, like just sort of like, yeah, if you have this, if you get into the mindset of the automatic bonus progression, then you get to get more excited about the cool, weird stuff.
Well, and I think you're really onto something with that kind of tradition there. When we're talking about the differences between the games, one of the things that will carry over from into Starfinder Second Edition playtest is that people who played Starfinder First Edition want to have the same sort of feel about things carry forward, right? If the the soldier isn't the one just laying down the damage, and if the vanguard when that comes around isn't just, you know, right, taking all the hits, then it just doesn't feel like you've carried over the tradition of what ought this thing do.
That's interesting. Well, because there's a change.
I think there's already, we're seeing changes in the classes from that, you know?
The specifically, like, the soldier is not necessarily the damage dealer, in the direct damage, single target kind of damage, right? The soldier is now the sort of broad area effect damager. Yeah.
Crowd control,
essentially, right? Suppressing condition. It is, in fact, the class that I was going to talk about is the operative is the direct damage dealer and is still that. It has, if you kind of like look at the stuff, it operative has the same proficiency progression with its guns that the fighter has. It gets legendary soldier. At 13th
yeah.
level.
Yeah.
No, not soldier, fighter from Pathfinder first okay. edition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The thing about superior hit.
The thing about fighter in Pathfinder second edition is that it is +2. That is its niche, right? It's +2 to hit. Pretty much throughout most of its career, it's going to be better at hitting
right.
with any weapon basically that a fighter picks up than any other class. And weird way, that's the most generic thing, but the operative has that essentially that +2, I think, for specifically for ranged guns with, you know, one exception to the specializations, but, it is that. So I was just kind of looking at that earlier and kind of comparing the fact that, oh, this is, I was looking at it and I saw like something at 19th level was like, you get legendary in weird weapon. I can't remember what is it? Uncommon, yeah, advanced guns. I'm like, advanced guns. When do you get it with the regular guns? Oh, 13th level. That's when fighter gets weapon legendary with a one. But that, you know, it's very specific. It's like for fighter, you get one category of weapons, I think, that you're legendary in, and then everything else is better. But that's the one you use. And you know, most people generally tend to stick to one type of weapon. So that's one thing that's sort of definitely operative. Again, not that different because you know, we all know that operative was the best at everything. In Starfinder first edition, but it is still pretty good at least shooting the gun, right? It doesn't get the skill bonus that it gets. That sort of using this skill monkey stuff is kind of like more envoy esque than operative. There's the one thing that carries over, the one name that carries over, the operative's edge, like with something that you would get, you got it first level at Starfinder first edition. You don't get that until 7th level and in the playtest. And that is just, you're better at perception and you get a little more, you basically get incredible initiative for free at 7th level. And if you already had it, it's a little bit better. So, you know, but it's not every skill you get a +1 in like operative.
Right. Well, and that's what, a little bit of the counterpoint to what you were saying. If you came into the operative going, I loved in Starfinder first edition how the operative did a ton of damage. Well, you're going to like that about the operative in Starfinder second edition. But if you came into the operative from Starfinder and said, I like the character that can do all the skills and get everything done. It says, well, the envoy kind of took that in a lot of ways from the operative.
It needed a little more niche protection, I think, and because the operative was kind of eating everybody else's lunches to a lot of ways, which is, you know, I mean, it's another thing, like, you know, you thinking about it being the space rogue, and the rogue does get a lot of skills, or, you know, but for the most part, when you talk about rogues, they are damage dealers in specific circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. And this is still the case in a lot of ways with the operative, too. You've got to do something to get that extra damage. And first edition was trick attack, which was an interesting mechanic, to throw that on. It wasn't always just like, oh, you know, flanking off, you know, off guard, et cetera, that you get the extra damage. It was make a skill check and then make an attack roll. So it was a little, double dependent, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had to succeed twice to get that extra damage in something. Second edition, Pathfinder simplifies that a lot, which is good because it's just basically the Starfinder second edition playtest operative is a little ranger, a little fighter, and a little rogue, kind of all kind of smooshed together mechanically and sort of flavorly. You know, you pick someone, you aim at them, then you can do damage to them. Basically, right? Now, if in Ranger, if you took the do extra damage, whatever the Ranger technique is.
The hunt prey.
Hunt prey is the thing, but then you can like hunt prey, you can have the flurry ranger, you can have the precision ranger.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right. I think that precision ranger is you only get that extra damage on the first attack you make. I was just kind of like looking at this. While aim is still an action, since you have three actions now, you can aim, shoot. And get that extra damage both times, like a rogue can stab and get that sneak attack damage every single time if they hit, right? If they happen to be, you know, someone who's off guard. So that's pretty interesting. And I started finding that kind of like it's the same kind of rotation in a lot of way, because, you know, rogue operators first is we're always trick attacking. Right, I'm gonna trick attack, which means I flip over here, boo, 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 and then I try to shoot again, and then I trick attack, and then I trick it, and that took your whole round to do. Mm-hmm. You could move while you were doing it, of course, so you could, you know, still have an active battlefield. But now I can aim at someone, boom, they're aimed, and then from here on out, I can do I do my regular attacks, and maybe, you know, we've seen, I guess to sort of pull the thing off, we've seen Scott and his operative do his sort of fancy attack, which does the thing, and does the extra damage, and then does a condition, right? Which is like, oh, aim, shoot. Yeah, so it's like pretty
all
cool.
At first level, too. I'm just shocked how much,
and
you know?
Yeah, it does a lot. And the one that he took, the operative exploit or specialization that he took, gives him a free second level feat, which is the reaction to someone moving. I think that might be a little too powerful.
Oh, yeah, crazy.
Because like it's
a ranged attack of opportunity is what he's getting, basically.
He's getting right. that, which is, you know, obviously, you know, fighter gets attack of opportunity, reactor strike right at first level, and that's fine, but that's so, you need to be near the fighter.
Yeah.
Scott can be anywhere, not anywhere, it's first range increment,
and
but
then
still.
Take the shot, yeah.
And then take the shot, yeah. So it's and that's weird that he gets that new, by taking that, what is it, the skirmisher specialization, getting this free second level feat at first level, which is kind of crazy.
Well,
do I have anything else to say? No, good, please.
Well, I wanted to jump in on the Mystic to switch gears for a little bit, and what I've seen there. In the Starfinder First Edition, the Mystics that I have played, really the healing ability you have comes from your spells, right? And you want to be more, you want to be a more of a healy Mystic. Well, then you take the connection that gives you Mystic Cure, right? You get more and more healy spells, but your spell list is where you look for those things. Now you do get. There's a downtime one, the healing font feature that Starfinder Mystics got, which is here is a pool that I will distribute, but you can only do it sort of outside of combat when there's sort of some, you know, in the middle of a rest anyway. But if you're resting that long, you're going to get all your stamina back. So I didn't find necessarily a lot of use for it.
It was always good for hit points. It was all for hit point damage.
Oh, that's
anyway,
true. If your stamina, you're going to get all your stamina points back. And then if you lost hit point, if you're into hit points as well, then the Mystic can kind of help with those. It did leave the Mystic, especially with spells that cure hit points. It meant the Mystic was sort of, you know, sitting there sort of looking at their nails and kind of waiting for somebody to get through their stamina points into their hit points before they would be like, oh, no, oh, I got that. Now I got that. That goes away in Starfinder Second Edition. The thing that really surprised me is that they didn't do sort of a straight across... Didn't do a straight across healing font kind of thing where it's like, oh, if you're going to be, you know, taking 10 minutes, then you can get a whole bunch of hit points back, because that's really in between combat healing is something that the medicine skill that treating wounds is for, that it's just in a lot of cases, it just ends up frankly a little bit hand wavy, like, okay, you've got some downtime, you patch everybody up and then away you go. There are some classes in Pathfinder Second Edition which have such good healing from a focus point level that as long as you get focus points back, you can even faster hand wave the healing, like a champion's lay on hands. A monk can do it to themselves with wholeness of body and things like that. So it surprised me that Mystics in Starfinder Second Edition got that ultra fast focus point healing in the form of their focus spell that gives the healing back to you. And on top of that is the non-spell vitality network that the Mystic builds in order to pull healing out of. So there ends up being spell ways to heal very quickly, like in combat. There ends up being the vitality network ways to, which is a non-spell way to heal quickly in combat. And if you're out of combat, the Mystic is going to heal you faster than people who are pulling out their bandages or med kits, I guess we ought to be fair about here. Yeah. But so that makes the Mystic feel like that niche protection is very much in the healing. And instead of making the healing that they got just specifically more powerful, what they did is they kind of broadened the different types of healing you can do. And that feels very useful. It feels nice to be a Mystic with a big toolbox of things to be able to do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you specifically took the healing connection, which is the one that gives you that focus point, the focus spell, basically.
That's right. The same way that a Mystic who took the healing connection in Starfinder First Edition, that's how they get all the Mystic Cure spells onto the list,
right.
Onto their list.
Yeah. I really enjoy the idea of the Vitality Network, this sort of like, it's, I don't want to say it's video gamey, but there's something about it that has this sort of like, well, I've got this pool, this resource that I can tick down, and it goes up kind of slowly, a little bit here and there, and then, but I can still spend it. No, maybe I get down to zero because we're really, really desperate, but it'll still tick back up kind of like naturally, mm-hmm. Which I really think is kind of cool that they, all mystics get this idea to kind of just be like, spread the love around, during, and it doesn't take any like other resources. It doesn't take any focus points. It doesn't take spell slots. It just kind of is this thing that exists that I think is really neat.
And as you mentioned, it remains, even if you're the sort of mystic who wants to lean away from that. If you were the sort of mm-hmm. first Starfinder first edition mystic who, I want to be a star shaman, I want to blast people with the energy motes, and I'm not going to prepare a lot of I'm not going to, you know, necessarily have a lot of healing for my party. That's not what I'm doing. I'm just, you know, I'm a little bit blasty. I'm throwing force discs and things like that. That becomes a perfectly valid way to play a mystic in Starfinder first edition, but then people kind of look at you and go, hey, where's my healing? And in, you're like, hey, give me 10 minutes and I can use the old healing font, right? That's but in Starfinder second edition, even the mystic that leans away from being the real, I want all the healing all the time, they still have that vitality network, which is very useful in kind of a clutch situation when you need it.
Yeah. It's an even better stabilize spell, essentially, right? Mm. Because it gives mm-hmm. you fully gives you hit points back, and it's only one action, and you get to kind of like tailor it. Like, oh, you only need like, I better save a couple hit points. You know, you're not going to accidentally use it all up. You can hold some back, right? You'd be like, I'm only going to give you four right now because I got to save the other six just in case, you know, the fighter goes down, you know, the soldier goes down. So yeah, so I think it's really kind of like, it's kind of elegant. It's simple and elegant, and it just sort of is a good expression of the mystic mm-hmm. kind of niche that is needed, because you know, like I said, the big change is you don't have stamina points anymore, right?
Right.
All hit points again all the time, mm-hmm. so you can't just be like, it's fine as long as I don't go through my stamina points. Everyone can just sort of take a breather, spend that resolve point, and get just a chunk of hit points back, right? Or, you know, damage, ability to take damage back. So you need this sort of healing. And, you know, Pathfinder has given it, the second edition stuff has been giving all these sort of ways, medicine and whatnot that
right.
really help the out of combat stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even in combat, you know, with battle medicine, yeah. you know.
Yeah.
You
don't have to be a cleric.
Right.
To do that, to do a battle medicine on somebody. And it's I've played a few games of second edition now. And it's always seeing that at least like one or two non sort of like bait, you know, healers have taken some form of battle medicine, whether or not they go and then they take natural medicine so they can use their nature on it, or I don't think there's another way to do it, but those are put a rank in medicine and, you know, try it out.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, that's, you know, my character that I'm playing, Witchwarper. My background is a doctor. I think it was background as a battle medic, maybe even. So I have battle medicine, and I did that intentionally so that we would have another non-healer who could heal.
Right. Just in case the actual healer like goes
in
down.
In case the healer goes down. Yeah. Thank you.
Who can at least get a little hit points in. And it's just so easy to get battle medicine as a skill feat. Like, why not?
And I think we have a couple of people that have that in addition to the mystic, you know, for healing. So that has not been a major issue so far, but, you know, first level just starting.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. I'd like to see a reevaluation of that. At the risk of saying something controversial, I think battle medicine is a bad feat. It's just not a very good feat because it's so valuable and so mandatory that I don't remember the last time I've been in a party or been with a party where multiple people don't get that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a sign that it ought to be sort of put on parity with some of the other ones. I really look forward to see what kind of options Starfinder second edition gives with that. Because the Starfinder team has made the in the past, like with Starfinder Enhanced, their idea hasn't been, okay, if things are a little bit too powerful, let's scale them back so much as they've been. If things are a little too powerful, let's bring everything else up to that. Let's count that as the bar and bring other things up to it. And that's really an exciting way to design the game.
Yeah, no, that would be cool, you know. First level feat, it is a pretty powerful thing. But one thing I'll say that I noticed quite a bit is the only having hit points and not seeming to have very many at first level compared when we had hit points and stamina points with first edition. I mean, every encounter seems like it's been really, really pretty scary, potential party wipe type of encounter that we've had so far.
You've been fine.
Yeah, yeah.
That's because we've got Jason the Grim Reaper Keeley as our GM, right?
I'm the softest GM there ever was, to be perfectly honest.
That's true. I'm entirely kidding about the Grim Reaper.
I've learned my lesson. A long time ago, I feel like, no, I mean, not that long ago, but a while back, I feel like I used to be a little more sort of like ruthless and whatnot. But I've coup de grace a paralyzed character once. And that was the last time I ever did anything like that.
Yeah, that's going to be really
honestly, because it was a huge downer.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's necessarily that we're that much softer in the second edition playtest, you know, lower hit points and stuff. I just think the frequency of critting is higher, right?
That's part of the system, yeah.
Right, the crit mechanic. So it just seems like that can happen more frequently. You know, when you get a couple of those back-to-back against you, that's rough. When you get a couple back-to-back against them, well, then, hey, that's great. But, you know, what goes around comes around. So, so I'll just touch base really quickly on the Witch Warper. Jason alluded to I'm playing one. You know, first edition, I had a Witch Warper. I didn't play it a lot, quite frankly. I didn't play it a lot. I had like 23 characters, so who knows which one you're going to. So I never played it through, major adventures and stuff like that. So I thought it'd be fun to play it in the playtest here. And a couple of things I noted, one of the things that made me really excited about it is the fact that you get a choice of, right now, of four different paradoxes. Two of them give you kind of arcane spell slots that you can take, and two of them give you an occult spell slots. And one of those is the precog paradox. Which, when I ran Horizons of the Vast with Ron playing a precog, that just looked like it was so much fun. You could do so much with it that I thought, oh, I really want to do this. And so, I thought it was interesting that they rolled in the precog basically into the Witch Warper, but I think it's kind of neat. It allows you really to customize your Witch Warper in terms of some of the feats you can choose, but also kind of the spell lists that you're able to pick from. So that's one thing I thought was pretty neat. Mm-hmm. Now, another difference and something that I haven't done a lot yet is you have this quantum field, which basically you can put in place around you and then start affecting the reality around you. It's pretty limited at, at low levels to what you can do, which is why I haven't used it in a lot of the situation we're at. But it really looks like over time as it scales, that's going to be a really cool thing in addition to your spell casting. So you have these two very kind of, magical or supernatural kind of things you can do that give you two very distinctive feels that are different than, a straight arcane caster or a straight I don't know what you call it, mystical caster, occult caster. Yeah. So it gives you a really cool mix of that, which is, I like quite a bit.
Remind me what your anchor is.
My anchor
object.
It is a physical object.
Right,
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, the mechanic on that is you kind of choose something there and that helps like center you again as you're going through right, stuff.
And, it's going through stuff.
Yeah, and I haven't. Yeah, go ahead.
It's sort of, Witchhopper has that sort of two-prong kind of like way to make your class in the way that Psychic does, right? You pick mm-hmm. this thing and this thing, and then there's like four of these or whatever, and that makes this sort of like terrific number of combinations between the two.
Yes, yeah, that's so it's like 16 different. Yeah,
something like that.
But yeah, so that's kind of what I've noticed. And, you know, at first level, I'm mostly casting stuff. You know, I haven't really spell casting and things I haven't really seen. The other thing that's interesting, and I don't even remember if this was the case with the Witchwarper before, that Constitution is your primary attribute. Was that the same with the Witchwarper before?
I really think it was Charisma.
I thought it was Charisma too.
Yeah, I don't think it's they kept that.
Yeah.
No, it's definitely different.
Yeah, it's Constitution now. And so I thought that was really cool because now I'm buffing that up. And so I'm this big sack of hit points too.
You can feel pretty
comfortable, you know, compared to other casters, right? Where you're not necessarily pumping up your Constitution. So
one of the things that was really exciting about the precog in Starfinder First Edition was not the reroll ability, but the pre-roll ability. And I don't think the current precog gets that. The second edition precog is Witchwarper gets that.
That would be like a kind of a huge mechanic, honestly.
Right.
Like that's why the precog is what the first edition precog is what it is, because that's a mechanic to base a class around, right?
Right.
And it's a full sort of like do this and then kind of like set these dice aside, right? It mostly maybe get a fortune effect. I don't fully know what else you get for the precog in terms of like focus spells or whatever, but like I would seem like reroll or I think there's one or two Pathfinder second edition spells that have
Investigator, right, for Pathfinder. Don't they have some sort of set the number and use the number later in second edition as well?
It's more or less a round by round situation.
Okay.
Where you
devise
a strategy and you roll a d20 and you go, oh, well, if I strike this person in that round, I have to use this d20 result for the next strike I make. And so you go like, oh, well, that's a terrible number. I'm not going to bother doing that. I want to do something else. And the remasters have added a little something that was, if you roll terrible, you can use that number. But you'd be like, not use the die number per se, but just be like, oh, instead of hitting, I'm just going to get a +1 to a skill check against this guy, but you get to roll that skill check as a normal d20. That number is just for attacks. So it's pretty cool. I think there's one, there is some, like, I think it might be in Dark Archive. There's like a Chrono Skimmer archetype.
Oh, that's right.
Which does weird time stuff. And I think there's some like thing where like, when you go do initiative, you can decide either to take 10 essentially on your initiative or roll. If you roll, I can't remember what it is. I have a friend of mine was playing it and I can't remember how it works, but it's like if you roll and you do well, you get this. If you roll and you do bad, you're like slowed or whatever. It's a weird kind of thing. Choose to go last in the initiative order maybe and you get a bonus, or you try to roll and I get to go first. Maybe there's no rolling. I don't know. It's definitely there's some things you can do with time magic and die rolls that are interesting, but you don't want to overdo it for one part of one class, right? Because then you have to do something just as wacky for gap influenced or from another dimension kind of stuff, right? That's where but you put them in the focus spells, right? If you can get something in the focus spells, which now that I think about it, John, I haven't seen you use your focus spells.
No, I don't think. I have not yet. In fact, I don't even remember what it is offhand. I'd have to go.
It's warp time, isn't it?
Appropriate time.
Is it warp time?
Yeah.
Okay. And what does warp time allow me to do? Because I don't remember now.
Warp time allows you to rewind or fast forward time as one action. It looks like you can either give yourself 10 temporary hit points. That's a rewind that lasts for 1 minute. Or you fast forward someone else's personal timeline and they take 1d10 void damage with a fortitude save. Okay. Basic fortitude save, essentially.
Right.
It's something, a little something, and you can always get that focus point back. I mean, focus spells are kind of meant to be used every encounter, kind of.
They're encounter spells, basically.
Right. Yeah.
You know what? I will tell you that I'll have to look at my sheet because maybe that's not something that came out because I don't remember having that. So I'm on my actual character looking at stuff I can do on Foundry.
Yeah.
I don't recall having that accessible to me.
Well, let me make sure that it's in your character sheet.
It exists.
Yeah.
Maybe that's my fault. With another question about the differences between the games. One of the things I remember people saying, and I felt this a little bit, between Pathfinder First Edition and Pathfinder Second Edition, is your choice of ancestry felt like instead of getting all the cool things, for example, that made you feel very dwarfy, you got very few dwarfy things. You had to pick from among them, and you kind of got all your other dwarfy, you got some more dwarfy stuff later on as you leveled up. And so it feel like it sort of, it really attenuated the ancestry choice as being maybe not as significant. Now, as somebody who tends to play humans, I really haven't seen that. But for people who if you've seen people in between Starfinder First Edition, Starfinder Second Edition, I wonder if they think that the species abilities, which were generally pretty front loaded, feel attenuated as ancestries in Starfinder Second Edition.
No, I think that's a fair point. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because since a playable species kind of had to fit in a sidebar, it wasn't often a lot, and we haven't seen much in the way of ones that did have big chunks of things. Mm-hmm. Like the Borai has a giant sidebar, but that's mainly because there's a big choice in there. It's like, oh dear, were you a human? Were you a Yosoki? And then you get these little bits and bobs, right? Now that's a versatile heritage, that kind of gets folded in. So you're basically doing that anyway, and you just get a little whatever the Borai gets. I don't know. I've heard people complain about like, well, why am I getting more dwarfy as I level up? Like, but what? Whatever. Like,
right.
For me personally, I think it's fine. Like, why you don't like getting more powerful? What's wrong with you?
Well, and one of the things I think that maybe this Starfinder Second Edition does better than Starfinder First Edition is that if you found a cool monster, right, in an alien archive or whatever, and you're like, oh, I kind of want to play one of these awesome monsters, and you look over at that little sidebar, you're like, oh, I can't do half the cool things the monster has if I'm a player. Reasonable, right? Game has to be balanced. But having ancestry feats that you get later make you maybe grow into that kind of awesome monster that you wanted. Okay, okay, that wasn't an ability we can give you at, you know, right out of the gate at first level, but we can give it to you at, if we can give it to you at fifth level or ninth level or 17th level, right? Then it becomes a thing that you know you can look forward to being like the thing you most wanted to be all along.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, I look forward to seeing more of the species in this ancestry format and seeing what, because, you know, like on a lot of too, like, I mean, there's more, like there's more stuff. Like if you were an elf in First Edition Pathfinder, you got some stuff and then that was pretty much it. But like now you can be an elf who eventually sort of does sort of get a 17th level, like, teleportation effect or something wild that you would have never really gotten unless you found a feat for it or whatever. Yeah, there were sort of ancestry feats back then, sure, but they didn't get taken a lot because you needed to kind of spend your feats on getting the plus ones where you need them and the extra damage when you need them, right? They weren't as mechanically robust or necessary. I personally would say I don't buy it. Well, the people who say that that the ancestry stuff in Pathfinder is like, I don't know, limiting or whatever. I think it's fine. You know, I think ancestry should not be monoliths of what they can do. Right. You know,
stereotypical everybody of this ancestry is exactly this.
You get
in real life, you don't have that.
Exactly. You get a little bit of like, well, because you're a dwarf, you can see in the dark. And that makes sense, right? Because every dwarf is a little bit undergroundy from an underground culture when they essentially evolved, if you want to think about it biologically. But like, you know, your dwarf may have grown up in a desert. Your dwarf may have grown up in the mountains. Your dwarf may have been in some other place, and you can do a little bit something that's different. You have that sort of more, just more diversity. I think, and I think that's cool. That's what I
like. Well, and the Starfinder has already shown, even in the playtest, that they're not afraid of going a lot zanier with some of the ancestries. It can be a floating gas bag right out of the gate. That's a...
wild that they put Baratheon. I love that. I mean, it makes sense to do that in the playtest because it's like... Because otherwise you're looking at just sort of different humanoids. And, mm-hmm, you know, right. You've seen that time and time again in all sorts of games. But what about... You know, sure, we've got some people have multiple arms. That's kind of cool. What about you didn't have any arms and you had tentacles instead and you were also a gas bag and you could also get a feat that lets you engulf another player and then you can act as one creature or whatever. I'm like, okay, yeah. That's Starfinder. That's what the mm-hmm. weird Starfinder stuff is.
Yeah, very cool. Well, this is interesting. I didn't realize that we were going to go so long touching on just some pretty basic things. I think we'll have to revisit this as we get more and more involved in the playtest.
Yeah, I could talk a little bit more about how the monsters end up feeling and stuff like that, too. Yeah,
How the monsters feel. Yeah, consider those. That's good. Oh, you mean how they feel as a GM running them?
Are they sticky? Are they smooth? Are they scaly? You know, that kind of stuff.
Oh, I thought you meant about monster feelings. I
got to touch a lot of more monsters before we meet again. So we should probably close out tonight. What am I saying?
Well, I'm John.
And I'm Ron.
And I'm Jason. And this has been Digital Divination.